Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Welcome to True Crime Cast. I'm John, here today without Jamie, just temporarily. So we're going to do something a little different today. We wanted to let you all hear a Patreon episode. Now, we said that we would not release these, and we're certainly not going to all the time, but this one that we wanted to share with you today is back from 2022, so over 3 years old. It is a very fascinating case because, as you will hear, there may or may not have been testimony in court from a ghost. Very interesting, and it's kind of a taste of what we do over on Patreon. So, as we wrap up the new year, and hopefully you all had a great Christmas and a very happy new year to come, we wanted to just gift you with this and hope you enjoy it. If you are interested in joining Patreon, just remember, as little as $3 a month gets you access to a bonus episode each and every month. And boys, I got to tell you, we have already recorded January's Patreon for January of 2026, and it is crazy. We are going to be talking about a pastor from the Carolinas named John Paul Miller, and he has recently been indicted. If you remember this case, his wife was found. She had committed suicide. A lot of people questioned whether it was actually suicide or not. We're going to dive into that, plus talk about some new indictments that have happened, and we're going to be joined at the end of that episode by a special guest who has researched this case and has a podcast and all kinds of documentaries out on it. Her name is Beth Braden. You guys have heard her on the show before, so she will join us at the end of that episode to talk a little bit about the case from her perspective and the work that she has done on the case. So without further ado, guys, thank you so much. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This started a long life of group homes, detention centers, and ultimately prison.
At what point did they intervene? Why didn't they intervene?
It's a situation that I would not want to find myself in. I would never want to get attacked, and I would never want to have to defend myself by killing somebody.
And the big question we always ask, John, is justice been served here?
This is True Crime Cast.
Welcome to True Crime Cast, Patreon edition. I'm John, here as always with Jamie. Dude, we got a good case today.
We really do. And there's just so much going on right now. I've got a new chair.
Yeah.
In the studio, and I don't even know what to do with myself.
It's cushy. The last chair, you've sat on a hard wooden chair for almost 2 years.
It's like you've been punishing me with the chair. I'm going to be honest.
I'm really sorry.
And I mean, our listeners may have heard it, because if I move, occasionally there was a little pop or a crack.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was my knee. Sometimes it was the chair. It's hard to tell.
I've got a new chair as well, and I'm not as excited about it as you are. It is not near as cushy as the one I used to have, but that one had to go back somewhere else. So.
Wow, that's very vague.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll leave a little mystery out there. So we've got a case that is just, you know, the most October-y, Halloween-y case ever. I said Halloween-y.
I know. I always think it's funny when people say Halloween-y. I'm very immature.
We'll get into it in a minute, but it is definitely involving a ghost that appears to someone and was used as part of a trial. I'm so excited to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's so real life.
Yeah.
But
not made up.
I do want to say Jamie has an update for you about a case we've been following forever. Two things, actually. Number one, dude, if you can believe it, next month will be 5 years that we've been doing the show.
It's insane.
And some of you all have been Patreon members almost that entire time. And that does not go unnoticed. We just want to say a huge thank you to everybody. But gosh, for those people who have been sticking around for so long, we are just so humbled. We love y'all.
And we try to say it often, but we literally would have quit doing this a long time ago without our Patreon supporters. That was kind of the only way early on that we could get equipment and it really kept us motivated. So thank you all so much.
Another Patreon / housekeeping issue that I've been made aware of is I think sometimes you guys may join Patreon and for some reason there's a glitch on our end in Patreon where it doesn't show up on the feed where we get your names for the shout outs at the beginning of the episode. So if you go a few weeks and don't hear your name, or we didn't read a review or something like that, shoot us an email, truecrimecast@gmail.com. Send us a message on our social media. We definitely want to read every one of your names. And sometimes Patreon's not perfect and it glitches and we're not being scumbags.
We never intentionally ignore those ever.
So yeah, just reach out to us. We want to make that right. So anyway, Jamie, you've been following the Adnan Syed case for years and years, and there was a major update. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, this was the big case from Serial Season 1, right? This, to me, is what put true crime into, I mean, it existed before that, but really, like, threw it into the popular culture and popularized it in a lot of ways. And in this case, 1999, Haman Lee was murdered in Maryland, and Adnan Syed, her ex-boyfriend, was arrested. A lot of the trial was based on testimony from his friend Jay Wilds and there was some cell phone ping evidence that was interesting, and they ultimately got a conviction. He's been appealing this the entire time, and just a few days before we recorded this, he walked out of prison after his conviction was vacated. So I just want to give people kind of in case you haven't read up on it or listened to anything, an update on what actually happened. So Maryland passed a law last year that if a juvenile had been in prison for 20 years or more, where they started in prison when they were a juvenile and they've been there for 20 years, then they could ask for a new sentence or a reduction in sentence or an early release.
Okay.
And Adnan was 17 when this crime happened. So his attorneys asked for him to be considered for early release because of this new law. And when the prosecutor started looking into it to say, hey, we're going to fight this or we'll recommend it, not only did they say, no, we probably shouldn't fight this, they started seeing things to say, how is this guy ever convicted in the first place? And here's some things that they found.
And that's the prosecution. The people
not the
who
defense.
Are the people who are responsible for putting him away.
Absolutely. So it's new people, but it's right. The same office, right? So they found several other things happening. So first of all, I think it was Bill Ritz or Bill Fritz, one of the investigators, was found to have essentially been dirty and had fabricated evidence in other cases that had been overturned. He was one of the main investigators in Adnan's case. Not that they had direct knowledge of him creating evidence, but he had been known to do so. So that's not a good look
and
to start out.
I think anytime somebody like that is responsible for prosecuting someone and putting them away, and then they're found in other cases to be misleading and even manufacturing false evidence, I think you got to do a thorough review on every case they've been involved in.
They read through Jay Wilds' testimony, and when we recorded this case, we named it Seven Stories because Jay Wilds told seven different stories of what happened, and all of them were very inconsistent. So the primary story of the prosecution was based on him. So this new prosecutor says none of his testimony like makes sense. And then the cell phone pings were a big piece of the prosecution. And that's saying that Jay Wild's story and where Haman's body and car were found matched up with where Adnan's phone pinged off of Towers.
Okay.
However, a lot of those calls were incoming calls, and cell phone tower pings are not reliable for incoming calls because a lot of times it can come off of the call that it's coming from or whatever. So they found that that's not reliable. Jay's not reliable. So this is probably not reliable. But the biggest thing was they found a couple notes from the investigation that nobody had ever seen before.
Okay.
I don't understand how like the Innocence Project and Adnan's new, and I don't know if the Innocence Project's actually been involved here, but Adnan's new attorneys have looked all through this and missed these notes, but they were there from investigators indicating two potential other suspects in this crime.
Oh, that's huge.
It is. And this had never been given to the defense from prosecution. So obviously that's a Brady violation, first of all, because you have to disclose any exculpatory information. These notes indicated that there was one individual that had threatened Haman Lee and seemed to have reason to want her to be dead.
Okay.
And the other person had a connection to Edmondson Avenue where her car was found. So one or both of those individuals, like they found this information and did no further investigation at all.
Oh, so they didn't really... They found the connection, but didn't dig into it.
No, they had Adnan, and they felt like they had a good case, so they ignored these other suspects. They didn't share it with the defense.
That is called tunnel vision.
So this new prosecutor finds it, and with just a little bit of digging, starts to find out, you know what? Maybe there is more to these other suspects. So in the biggest integrity move I think we've ever covered on this podcast, the prosecutor files a motion saying, based on what I've read and what I found, these notes, the cell phone pings, the dirty investigator, and Jay Wilds being unreliable, I have no confidence in this conviction. I think it should never have happened. I'm moving that it be vacated. And of course, the defense is like, cool, go ahead.
Yeah.
So he's on home arrest right now while they continue the investigation. Most people don't think he's going to be re-prosecuted. So there could be a matter of months, and then he's completely free from this.
Okay, let's pretend like I'm five, all right?
Yep.
Let's say that, so right now his conviction is still upheld.
No, it's vacated. Like, he's never been convicted of this crime at this point.
Okay, well then, if for some reason they find more evidence suggesting that it is him, how, like... You're saying
they would have to make the decision to start another trial.
Well, how come, like, why wouldn't the jeopardy or the double jeopardy clause kick in there? Because he'd already been tried, convicted, and it had been overturned.
It was overturned. The conviction was vacated as if like it was a mistrial. So it's not like he was acquitted. You can't be retried if you're acquitted, but if there's a mistrial, you can be. So
I feel like that's a loophole that he's stuck in this everlasting
and he could be and that's part of the problem here. And I just, based on the integrity they've shown already, I have confidence that this prosecutor is gonna, as soon as they say, you know what, we're going another direction, they're gonna completely release him. Obviously he's gonna be entitled to lots and lots of money for wrongful imprisonment and conviction, and so many people have always thought that he was innocent. Of course, they at least convinced 12 people that he was guilty, right? So,
right. So
there are going to be those that still feel that way. Most of all, I feel for Haman Lee's family having to relive all this once again. But I think for them, they would rather have the right person in prison than just have it over with. So yeah. Hopefully we can get to the bottom and get to some real concrete evidence of who did this, because that never really existed in the first trial.
Yeah.
Or the second or the third.
I mean, yeah, potentially with him out of jail. Well, with him out of jail, I mean, we know that the person responsible for her death is not being punished right now.
Right.
Whether that's him, Jay, or anybody else.
Yeah.
So I just hope we have more updates sooner than later of somebody, you know, being arrested and ultimately convicted of her murder based on, like, hard facts.
But in the true crime podcasting world, that may be the biggest news out of the last 15 years. So it's huge. So I guess that would probably make it the biggest news ever, because podcasting hasn't been around for too much longer than that, especially the true crime genre. So,
well, and I think, you know, every case is important because of the victims and the families of the victims. But like for that case in particular, that is the case that really jump-started True Crime Cast. I mean, there was that case and then the Tara Grinstead case out of Georgia.
Yep.
Those two cases combined, we wouldn't be here had we not been super interested in following those cases. So to sit here on our five-year anniversary of the show, still talking about that case, that tells you how much it means to us.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that she gets some justice, and if Adnan is shown to be innocent, then he is set free and compensated like He was 17 when he went in prison. He's essentially our age.
Yeah.
And he's been in prison for 23 years. So
yeah, he's a little older than me. Yeah, to think about 1999. I mean, that was 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I've lived so much life in that time. I finished high school, went to college, met my wife, had my children, and he's been robbed of all that if he's innocent. And that's, you know, you can be compensated financially for that, but that's not even a drop in the bucket to having those years robbed from you.
You can't give time back.
Those are the best years of your life. And if he is innocent, we've robbed him of that.
Yeah. So we'll, again, keep you posted if there are more updates on the case as far as new people being prosecuted. They've not released the names of the other suspects. I think there are some names in the files. You may be able to go back and tie those two if you're really wanting to be an internet sleuth. But I've not done that. They're doing that just to maintain the privacy of the investigation. So we'll keep you posted on that. But if you thought that was exciting and wild, it's about to get wilder and excitinger.
This case is crazy. And I mean, it wouldn't happen today, I don't think.
I completely agree.
But we've got to go back all the way to the 1800s, 1886 to be precise. Man, like, first off,
before I was born.
Yeah, like, you know, our kids are going to look back at the 1900s, like when we grew up, as if it was the 1880s for us. You know
what
I mean?
The fact that the phrase the 1900s is part of the public lexicon really bothers me.
And kids are like, were you born in the 1900s? Yes.
Yeah, that was 22 years ago, Holmes.
And I remember, like, looking at documents of my great-grandfather, you know, and he was born in the late 1800s, and that's how my grandchildren are going to look at me, like this old ancient man who was born in a different millennia.
I just assumed that everything was in black and white and that all men wore black suits and black hats with a brim all the way around. I wonder if our kids think of us as just being like, everything's really grainy and not very clear. We're very pixelated.
Yeah, we're not HD. So in late 1886, Elva Zona Heister married a man named Trout Shoe, and which is just a ridiculous name.
That's Trout. Well, even Elva Zona.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
He wasn't saying Arizona.
Yeah, Elva Zona. But then to name your son Trout, like, man, like some fish. But a little backstory before their marriage, Elva Zona had a child out of wedlock, and she was, and the child's father left before that child was born. Elva Zona was an attractive young woman. You can actually find pictures of her online, and she looks like she's from the 1800s, so I really don't see it. You know what I mean?
Black and white picture.
But, I mean, I guess women from back then could be attractive.
I don't know that it's
very subjective.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that in the 1800s, like, you didn't have a lot of competition, you know?
Just imagine, like, I mean, the hairdos are different, the style's different, but I feel like people didn't smile in pictures then.
They couldn't, because it took them like 5 minutes to take a picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, off the air, we need to have a conversation about Elaine from Seinfeld. I wonder if you, but anyway, she was an attractive young woman. So several men in the area were interested in dating her, but her mom was kind of like a manager. She would interview the young men to make sure they were up to par for her daughter.
I like it.
I don't I don't know. I don't want to be interested in a woman and then have to talk to her mom and. I don't know. That's
but wouldn't you like to get to know the young man that's going to date your daughter? I'm not saying it's a formal interview.
I didn't want me to be in that place, but I'm definitely going to be in that role for my future.
Okay. Yeah. Daughter. I don't know about a formal interview, but I got some questions, dog.
Yeah. And I'll have my guns out while I ask those questions.
You're going to wear a sleeveless shirt?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Sun's out, baby. Guns out.
Yeah. Anyway, Elva Zona met Trout at a blacksmith shop.
Because that's what people did.
Yeah, he worked in a blacksmith shop. She said he was a strong, attractive man who had the voice of an angel when he would sing. However, her mama Mary did not like him. And in particular, she didn't like that he was 12 years older than her daughter. Yet love would prevail, and they would end up getting married. So an interesting story about their marriage. And if my daughter ever does this to me or my future son-in-law, like, I might murder him. So Trout went out to get a marriage license, but inexplicably to me, he got it for the wrong county. So I know in Tennessee, and I'm sure it's like that here in Kentucky, you have to obtain your marriage license from the county that you live in.
Yeah.
So I don't know why he got it from another county. I don't know. So he got the marriage license from the wrong county, but of course their original plan was to get married in their home county. So he had to go out, find a pastor that would be agree to walk down an old dirt road in the middle of nowhere across the county line to officiate the wedding. And the worst part of this is that it was 2 o'clock in the morning. They had to walk so far. They didn't get there until 2 o'clock in the morning. And you know, the part in the ceremony where the pastor will ask if anybody has an objection to this wedding, speak now or forever hold your peace.
Yeah.
He objected. Like he got that far into the process and he's like, you know what, guys, I object. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. We're on a dirt road in the middle of nowhere. Nobody's family is here. This just seems shady. So he ended up not marrying them. They had to go home unwed. And the next day they found a pastor that would marry him. So
that is so interesting. And this is in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, in case people are wondering like where this is when we're talking about counties. Everything here in Kentucky we refer to as, oh, well, that's over in so-and-so county or down in whatever county. I think it's similar in other states like Georgia. Is it like that all the time in Tennessee?
Yeah.
Okay.
I to be fair, I got a text and I wasn't listening to you. We can leave that in. What was your question?
I was texting too. Does everything go by county in Tennessee? Like in conversationally?
No, we say cities. Sorry.
Yeah.
I answered incorrectly because I was not listening to you.
So Elvazona and her new husband Trout lived in a two-story log cabin. That's fancy. They had only been married for about 3 months, and in January of 1897, Elvazona Heaster Shoe was found dead in her home. She was sick, and it said that Trout sent a young boy who was 12 years old to go home to help her do her chores since she wasn't able to get up and do them. She needed her rest. But when the boy got to the home, he found Elvazona laying dead at the bottom of the step. So he immediately sprinted back to Trout to tell him what he found.
By all accounts, early in their marriage, everything seemed great. They were happy. They enjoyed their time together. Her mom would say that they would like build a fire in the fireplace and snuggle up together. So everything seemed fine. After just a few months, she would get sick. And that's when Trout asked the boy to go in and check on her, maybe run to the store if she needed it, and to help her with any chores that she needed. And some believe that the reason she was ill may have been that she was pregnant. But again, it's the 1800s. You can't go to the Dollar General and buy a pregnancy test.
Right. I mean, I don't know her exact symptoms, but it's certainly possible.
So on the day that this boy would find her, Trout was asking him all morning to go over and help. So it wasn't like he had an arrangement like, hey, sometime today, can you go over? But this Trout was like hounding this kid.
Yeah.
So basically Trout was setting this kid up to find Elvazona. So the boy got there after lunch. He would knock on the doors. Nobody would answer. And with her not answering and her being sick, he basically broke into the house. Like you said, he found her. And then he runs home and tells his mom, and his mom tells him to go tell Trout.
Trout immediately sprinted home to find Elvazona laying on the floor like the boy had said. Immediately, he took her upstairs, washed her body, and prepared her for burial. Again, this is the 1800s, right? I don't know the common practice, but I can't imagine my job as a husband would be to immediately prepare my wife for burial. I feel like culturally, at least, there would be like a mourning period, and there are processes for a mortician to do this, even in the 1800s, I would think.
Yeah. And I don't think it would have been expected for him to have to be the one to prepare. I mean, they would have had family and friends that would have let him grieve and mourn, and they would have stepped in and done that. So I don't think that it was common.
He dressed her in her burial clothing, and that would consist of an older outfit that had a really stiff-necked collar, which is going to be an important factor here. And it was the same dress that they got married in. It's when he was finishing this that the town's doctor and medical examiner, and I mean, at that time, doctors did anything pertaining to health at that time, finally arrived at their house. And when he got there, Trout's holding his wife's head in his lap and refused to move and let the doctor do a full examination. Of course, he's crying, he's upset, but he refuses to move from the spot of cradling her head in his lap.
So the doctor would look her over for about an hour, but again, Trout would not stop holding her head in his lap, and he was basically making a scene, just crying, weeping, and refused to move so the doctor could give her a thorough look over. The doctor would leave and would document that the cause of death, and get this, Jamie, her documented cause of death from the medical exam was everlasting faint.
That, so is that just saying like she fell asleep and won't ever wake up?
Well, I think of someone who's fainted, you know, they passed out and she's just in an everlasting state of being faint. Basically, she's dead.
That just seems so weird. Yeah, I mean, that seems like it's not a reason at all to be dead.
So even during her funeral and the wake, first off, I'm sorry, I'm going to go down a rabbit hole. You and I are from old time rural communities. Have you ever been to a wake that's not at the funeral home?
No, but I mean, people used to stay up all night with the dead, with the body and the casket in their house.
It's no wonder that I do a true crime podcast, because not only did I listen to or watch Unsolved Mysteries with my mom every night, my uncle passed away probably in the early 90s. And I remember driving to a house that I already considered haunted and having an old timey wooden casket in the middle of our living room at that house. And we stayed there all night long, and they had put, fabric over the lamps, so it was really dim and extra creepy. I can't believe that I got to witness this in my lifetime. And that house had an outhouse.
Oh yeah.
So if I had to use the bathroom, I had to walk through the dark woods to an outhouse. Like, I feel like maybe one night I just transferred myself to the 1800s, because that's how ridiculous this was.
So am I wrong in that part of why they do that is kind of to make sure they're dead? Like, you spend all night just in case they wake up. Am I making that up?
Yeah, maybe their everlasting faint turns into just
a temporary prolonged faint.
Temporary faint. Yeah, I don't know, man, but I mean, he was dead. This was the 90s. We just reverted back to the old ways.
1990s.
Yeah. So, but even at her funeral and wake, Trout would not move from the side of his wife. He would cradle her head even during the wake and the funeral. The only time that he would leave her side was when they closed the casket, and they couldn't open it back up without him and his permission. So she would be buried in the Methodist plot there at their local church.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, this could just be a man in total grief not leaving his wife's side. But if we're covering it, then it seems more like he's trying to prevent people from seeing something. And this is when things take a big turn, right? Mary, who is her mother, was obviously grieving the loss of her daughter, and she was left with no answers as to why she had died. She knew she was sick, but not this sick, right? So she prayed to God to give her some kind of answers. God, tell me why my daughter died. What happened? And this is when, according to Mary, she saw her daughter. She said her daughter came to her from the afterlife to tell her exactly what happened the day that she died.
This was like a full-figured premonition, like a ghost, but like, it looked like her, like from head to toe.
Like a vision, like a full-fledged Old Testament, this is what I'm seeing happening before my eyes to deliver a message to me.
Exactly.
So Elva came back and said that Trout had gotten mad because she didn't have meat for supper, and he squeezed her neck so hard that it broke. Go back to everything we said. So this is like the flashback part of the movie, right? Like, she's wearing the stiff-necked thing. He's holding her head and not letting people see it, and he won't let anybody touch her body. So now this ghost of Elvazona is saying, my husband broke my neck.
Yeah. Well, it gets even wilder, man. So her mom, Mary, took this information to the county prosecutor. And I don't know, if something happened to one of my children and I saw their ghost, I don't know that I'm going to go tell somebody in fear of them thinking I'm crazy. But she did, and he didn't think she was crazy. He did not dismiss her.
Do you think this is just like a sign of the times, like were people just more spiritually inclined at that time, maybe?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Maybe it was a, well, okay, tell me more.
Yeah, I mean, science definitely isn't something they're considering
too much. We need to have antibiotics.
Yeah, let's talk to a ghost.
Yeah.
So this gentleman reached out to the doctor / medical examiner, and the doctor stated, yeah, I wasn't really able to perform a full inspection of Elva because her husband wouldn't leave her side and he kept holding her head. So the prosecutor is like, well, let's try this again. So that he ordered that they exhume her body and for her to be re-examined. Put yourself in Trout's shoes. You probably murdered your wife and you're not happy that this is going to happen. He didn't want her to be exhumed. He tried to fight it, but ultimately, I mean, the order stood. And once they were able to get her out and look her over again, they found exactly what the ghost had said was accurate. And they found that she had fingerprinting on her neck. Her trachea was collapsed. Her neck was broken. I mean, everything that the ghost told Mary was legit.
And again, this came from Mary to the prosecutor after Mary had not spent time alone with the body and then was verified on the viewing. So,
and Mary wasn't even there, you know, at the house when the medical examiner was performing his duties. So
she has no way of knowing.
She had no way of knowing unless Trout said, yeah, I held her head for the whole time, but I don't think he would have done that.
Insane. Yeah. It's just the fact that this was corroborated is incredibly shocking. And they made the findings pretty public quickly and everybody got all riled up. Shu ended up being arrested and charged with the murder of his wife. He was taken to the jail at Lewisburg, where he was held until he was indicted by a grand jury in June of that year. In the meantime, more information came out about him, and Elvazona was not his first wife. An investigation into Trout Shu's background showed that he had served a term in a penitentiary and had been married twice previously, and both of his previous wives had died under strange circumstances. One wife was supposed to have died from a broken neck when she fell from a haystack. The other wife died while helping Shu repair a chimney. She was on top of the chimney and his wife was placing the rocks in a basket with a rope attached to it. And as the basket was drawn up, the basket turned over and dropped the rocks on the head of his wife to kill her. Both very bizarre ways to die. And you put these three deaths together and it looks pretty unbelievable.
On June 22nd, 1897, the jury returned a verdict of guilty after they only deliberated for an hour and 10 minutes. The accounts in the Independent, which was a newspaper, made it clear that Shu was convicted of murder of his third wife on circumstantial evidence and not because of the ghost testimony. But again, Mary did testify in court that a ghost of her daughter came to tell her all this. So you can say that it wasn't the sole basis on his guilty verdict, but it definitely involved a ghost basically testifying in trial.
Yeah.
Through Mary.
And well, I guess ultimately they did have the evidence of her neck being broken and the fingerprints being there. So maybe that was enough to convict him.
Yeah.
But I think the whole town had already heard about this ghost situation, so you can't rule out it being a factor, I wouldn't think.
Well, and without the ghost coming to Mary, she wouldn't have known about it. She wouldn't have been able to take it to the prosecutor who had her exhumed and reevaluated. So, I mean, the ghost is really the hinge of all this. So he was sentenced to life in prison, and he, on his way to jail, the 1800s were so much different than today. But on his way to jail, the night he was arrested, there was a mob formed trying to lynch him for murdering his wife. The sheriff was prepared to die in protecting Shu, and so they kind of just dissipated. But He ended up dying just a few years after being in prison. He died in March of 1900, and that was the cause of death was due to an epidemic. And there could have been a few different things. Most likely measles was killed him.
That was before the Spanish flu epidemic that resembled COVID-19 in practice. But yeah, and I'm not surprised. I feel like lynching attempts were very common at that time. And all of that information is coming from the movie Tombstone for me. So I think it's pretty accurate. I'm just kidding. But yeah, it's such a crazy story. And believe what you want to believe about the ghosts. But for whatever the reason, her vision, premonition, if you want to believe it was a made-up story, led to the exhumation of the body, which proved that she had been murdered at the hands of someone, which had to be her husband at this time. So whatever the reason that led to this, this led to justice being served for this young lady and her family. So I'm not saying you should make up premonitions or visions, but whatever, whether it, and it may have actually happened. I don't want to rule that out either. Not a big ghost guy over here, but
see, I'm the opposite. I absolutely think that she saw something. I mean, she's religious. She was praying to God, asking for help. And I think whether or not there's ghosts that walk around us every single day, or God helped her see the vision so that justice could be served, I don't know, but I definitely think she wasn't making it up.
Yeah, and it was corroborated by evidence, so it's hard to make that argument. Yeah, this is wild.
I love a good ghost story.
And as far as we know, this is the first time that a ghost has played a role in a murder prosecution.
I didn't write it down, but there is definitely a plaque at that Greenbrier courthouse that refers to this case, because it was definitely the first and potentially only time a ghost has been a witness in court.
Yeah. Guys, hope you enjoyed this one. Certainly a different type case, but a wild one nonetheless. And just to reiterate what we said earlier, cannot thank you all enough for your ongoing support of our show and our Patreon work as well. At this point, we have like a full catalog of episodes here too.
Yeah. Guys, we love you. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you so much.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.